I was 9 months pregnant with our second child, conceived in a moment of trying to fix our crumbling marriage. For the 2 weeks leading up to labor, I was being stonewalled. My transgression? Daring to insist that my husband put his coffee in a travel mug on the morning of my grandmother's funeral so that we could ensure we arrived on time. He wanted to tempt fate with traffic and enjoy a leisurely coffee while reading the news. Suffice to say, things were tense. This was a VBAC labor, and my doctor was adamant that I get the epidural on the minute chance my cesarean scar from 4 years prior might rupture during birth. I wanted as natural a birth as possible. I knew it was my last pregnancy, and I wanted my body to do what millions of women's bodies before mine have done. Plus, I hate needles. Needles in my spine? No thanks. But I acquiesced and found myself hunched forward on that sterile bed while a man with a needle poked my spine. Here's where things started to go really bad. I was in back labor. For the uninitiated, that means my baby's head was grinding on my spine on her way down. It was intense, blinding pain. The worst position to be in back labor is, well, on your back. The best place to be in is on your hands and knees, doggy style, to relieve some pressure. But that epidural, it didn't take properly. I was numb from about mid-thigh down. So I could feel all the pain in my abdomen and pelvis area, but couldn't rotate onto my knees for relief because I couldn't feel my legs. The pain became unbearable. I literally felt like I was being torn in two with a dull blade. Adjusting the epidural wasn't possible, so what did the doctors do? They gave me fentanyl. I went from blinding pain to an absolute disconnect from my body, like I was a floating head. At this time, baby's heartbeat was slowing, and I was encouraged to push. Any idea how hard it is to push a baby through a body you can't feel? I was terrified, and I pushed so hard that I broke a bunch of blood vessels in my face and received a third-degree tear. But phew, baby was born safe and healthy, and now it was time for me to get a well-deserved rest, or so one would think. But this was not the end of my ordeal. My ex insisted on sleeping in the hospital room chair with baby on his chest instead of the bassinet. I had read a tragic story just days earlier where a newborn baby suffocated in the crook of her dad's arm after he had fallen asleep. I begged him to put her in the bassinet so we could all get some rest, but guess what? He refused. I wasn't able to get out of bed and put her there myself, and I couldn't rest with the terrifying idea that my brand new baby girl could meet the same demise. That was a trauma all its own. Who argues with a new mom that had literally just gone through war with her body? Who denies a woman assurance that her newborn is safe so she can rest? He did eventually put her down, but it wasn't without a fight, and that's something I'll never forget for the rest of my life. Hi, I'm Zahn Valines, and this is the Liberating Motherhood Podcast. Today, we are going to be talking about birth as a site of abuse, but also a potential source of radicalization and collective healing. I'm here today with my guest, Sabia Wade. Hi, Sabia.
Hey.
I am
That
so
was a very
excited to have you here.
interesting story and had
No.
so many thoughts and feelings as you were
I
reading that.
share them. Just go for it.
So many things. It just brought up for me, like when I teach, my doulas, I'm always talking about like how much one, how important it is to know the different things that can happen, right? And like there's no way to know everything, but as far as like the, I guess what we call complications, like letting them know what that is, but more so, especially as a doula, like holding the emotional space, and that in the time of pregnancy and labor, relationships, right, can really move through a lot of ups and downs, even if the pregnancy was something that was desired, right? Like that is a time where you learn where your partner has some things to work on, where you have some things to work on. How do you deal with conflict, right? And like, how do you deal with trauma that is occurring like at the time? And also, how does each person deal with it after the fact, right? How people grieve is so much different than the next person. What we may be thinking is like someone being selfish, someone being whatever, might really be sometimes like a trauma response and or lack of maturity, right? We have to like kind of get into which one it is, but it's just so many elements to that experience that really speaks to the holistic experience of pregnancy and labor for everybody.
Totally. It's so intense. And you know, the thing I often hear from women is my partner did a bait and switch. He was fine until we had kids and then he changed. And I think what's actually happening is not that he just decided, oh, there's a child here now, I'll change. It's that children put demands on a relationship that were not there before, and a lot of men
For
just don't want to
sure.
rise to that.
For sure. I think people, it's really wild because we often, so as a doula and just as a reproductive justice like advocate, we talk about childbirth education. And childbirth education gets into, what to expect and how to bring some comfort and all these things. But I think it's super important in that time to talk about exactly what you're saying, right? And to really talk about like what does it mean to parent? What is the role that you think you play in this process? What is that with couples? I see that as being like the really big, distinct mismatch. It's like, the partner who's pregnant is thinking the other partner is going to be 50%, 75% in doing whatever, but they feel pretty detached. They're like, well, baby's not feeding for me. Baby doesn't want me. I'm just going to sit over here in the corner, right? So how do we get them to be integrated? And also, how do we have those prior conversations before birth, if we can, before pregnancy, about what it looks like to be a parent for real? And if we match on that level, and if we should actually have children together, sometimes it's not quite a good idea, even though our relationship was a good idea when it was just us.
A lot of relationships just can't or shouldn't contain children. Okay, so I'm gonna do your bio and then we'll get into some more questions because I don't want to miss that part of telling
For
people who you
sure.
are. Sabia Wade is a Black, queer, multidisciplinary reproductive justice advocate, entrepreneur, and thought leader. As the creator and CEO of Birthing Advocacy Doula Trainings and founder of For the Village, Sabia has built accessible pathways for community care workers and birth justice advocates across the country. With roots as a volunteer doula at the Prison Birth Project, Sabia's work now spans curriculum design, organizational strategy, full-spectrum doula care, and executive coaching. They are also the author of Birthing Liberation: How Reproductive Justice Can Set Us Free, a groundbreaking exploration of bias, healing, and collective freedom in reproductive care. Beyond advocacy and education, Sabia leads Tend and Mend Healing Studio in Wilmington, North Carolina, offering herbalism, spiritual care, mediumship, death doula support, and human design sessions, bringing a holistic, liberatory approach to healing and leadership. That's a lot of stuff.
And when people
So,
read it, I'm like, that's me.
yeah, that's you. And so I learned about you through your book, Birthing Liberation. And a lot of what you're doing, of course, comes through in the book. But then I started researching more of your work and bio for this interview. And I was just really struck by how very much you're doing out there in the world. So maybe we could start by talking about how you came to be who you are and how you see yourself.
Sure. How I see myself is, I think I see myself as someone who wants to enjoy my experience on Earth. Like, when I wake up, I want to, I mean, I'm not always excited every single day, but I want to feel like I understand why I'm here. And I understand that what I do is important, as well as it makes me feel good. And me feeling good also helps me to expand my work into the community, to help folks as much as I can, to educate. Like, all those things are really important to me. So how I see myself is just like an adventurer, a lifelong learner, and someone who is just a bleeding heart, sometimes to a fault. But then when it comes to how I've gotten here, where I would say the center of my work, my center of my life has always been care. To be honest, when I started, the first time I realized how much I cared about like community and people was working in a restaurant. I was working in Fridays, and I remember I started off as a busser. I moved up to doing taking like to go orders. I moved up to being a server, and I was like, I love working with people. I want to be like a restaurant manager. Then I went into long story less long. I went to being a certified nursing assistant, and that's just like you got. Well, I guess not everyone cares about people in that way, but I feel like when you do that work, it's so intimate. Like you're caring for people at their most vulnerable times. But I was like fascinated. I mean, some of it is like, you know, it's dirty work. But it never felt like, I don't know, it never felt like I was in my wrong space or it was too gross. It was like I wanted to care for people. So I thought maybe being a doctor or something like that. But then I don't really like going to school. So I was like I'm good with school, but I find it to be boring. And like in our like Western kind of way that we see education, like I want to be like out in the field doing something, not just learning for years and years and years, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Anyway, I found doula work, and then I moved from Philadelphia to Massachusetts, and I became a prison birth project doula as a volunteer. So I started working with incarcerated people, formerly incarcerated, people who use drugs, people in recovery. And that's when I really fell in love with reproductive justice. I, one, never thought about people being pregnant in while they're incarcerated. I just didn't think about that. And then also being able to hear and be in relationship with those people, I was able to hear their stories, hear about their childhoods, hear about different things systemically that impacted them, different things that also made me realize that we're all, even though we all kind of try to separate ourselves from like the incarcerated population or this population, it's like you never know what could happen and what maybe put you in a position to have to be active in that way. So I just fell in love with the work, and I've just never left the work since then. So I've had iterations of my first organization for the village in San Diego. We serve about 100 to 150 people a year with doula services. Then I created BADT. We train thousands of people all over the world in birth work and care work. And the healing modalities that I've practiced, I actually pr started practicing those even before I became a doula. So I've always been into healing arts. And so I don't know, the simple way to put it is like I want to be myself in all aspects of my life. And so it's taken some time to create that, but I feel like it's there now. And it may seem like a lot of labels and a lot of things, but it's more so because I don't see myself as only one avenue or one thing, right? I let myself be whole, and I show that through my work.
I love that about you. And I think that's also very inspirational to listeners because I know that I have a lot of listeners who are kind of trying to figure out what they're doing in their lives, often pursuing second and third acts after escaping abusive relationships or like coming out of incarceration. And I think a lot of them feel pressure to like pick this one job and that's the thing you do and that's the thing that you are. And so I think just hearing from someone who's doing a little bit of all the things they like is just so helpful and inspirational, and I just love that.
So people know I love a rebrand. Like when people come into their second, third lives, I tend to like I coach people, and I love that person, right? Because the thing about that person when they're in their second rebrand, third rebrand, whatever, they know what they don't like,
Yes.
and that to me is so helpful. I think it's like in the beginning of your journey, like you know, when I was in like my 20s and trying to figure out what I didn't have enough experience to name what I don't like, who I am, you know. Where I strive at, where I don't strive at. That second or third act, you're like, I know that this is not for me. You know? And like we could build from there. I'm like, if you know what's not for you, we can start moving you into what is for you. And I think that's a blessing.
I think that's great. I want to talk to you a little bit about prison birth. I know the latest statistic is between 5 and 10% of incarcerated women enter the system pregnant, and unfortunately, some more end up pregnant, often due to assault or coercion or
Mm-hmm.
rape, once they're there. And this is something that I find, most people don't really think about. And so, if you wouldn't mind just talking a little bit about this phenomenon, because again, you're right, like people separate themselves from incarcerated people. And the truth is, it could be a lot of us, and we need to really care about and be concerned about this.
Yes. So one of the things that I think was most impactful for me was realizing how many people were in there for survival crimes. I think a lot of times, because I remember we went to we did a training with the Prison Birth Project, and the founder is Marianne Bulloch, and that's still one of my mentors and friends and people I go to 10 years later. And I remember we did our training in-house, right? So we talked about reproductive justice, we talked about this, we talked about that, and I was like, okay, cool. And then I remember we had to do a training in the prison. And so in the prison, it was a totally different tone, right? It was like, don't touch them, don't trust them, don't do this, don't do that, manipulation, blah, 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 blah. Right. And I'm like, whoa, okay. And I was like, can we find somewhere in the middle? Like there was no middle. So I remember talking to people that I met and realizing that, yeah, I'm not saying that everyone's perfect. There was, people do things that they probably shouldn't be doing. However, a lot of it was I was doing XYZ crime to put food in my kid's mouth, right? A lot of it was I was doing XYZ because I was being trafficked, right? A lot of it was I had no escape and I had to do certain things to survive. And so I think that part gets missed. And another one, too, this was back in 2015. So we were talking about the opioid crisis, but not nearly as much as we do now. And the thing that really surprised me was a lot of people who were there for drug-related charges, when I would ask them kind of like their origin story, a lot of them had like very legitimate injuries, right? And they would go to the doctor and get prescribed this medication. Now we have documentaries that talk about that time. Now we have documentaries that talk about how many people were overprescribed medication, how many people were making money off of it, and how this epidemic became what it is. But at that time, it wasn't that figured out yet. So it was just a lot of like where people should have probably been in a rehab facilitation facility, they were not there, right? Where people should have been in maybe other spaces, they were not there. They were incarcerated. And so there are obviously some people that had did crimes that, you got to go to jail. But a lot of people were there in my opinion, in that time. They were there when they should have been in other spaces. And they were there when they should have been getting earlier intervention. They were there when they should have been supported by their community, by these systems, way more. As well as they were also navigating having other children. And so their other children would be, under the care of their family members or maybe foster care. And so many of them were talking to the social worker, trying to see their children, trying to still maintain a relationship with their children. And it was nearly impossible because a lot of these social workers are also way overloaded. So it was just a really, I think it really opens your mind to like everyone that we label as bad is not bad. Sometimes the people we label as bad just don't have access. And I think if we thought about that a little bit more, it would change the way that we view incarceration in general.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that strikes me is that in supremacy culture, prison is where we put people who we don't want to deal with. And some of them we don't want to deal with because they've done crimes and we don't want to ask why. But a lot of it's because we don't have the resources to help with problems. And so it's just you go here. And then it's far more punitive than just being locked away. People who are incarcerated are, as you've said, just totally and completely dehumanized.
For sure. And I think too that people miss the fact that I remember being there and talking to some of the folks there, and they were trying to get into rehab, but a lot of people don't know that our rehab I guess, system, as you would say, is overwhelmed, right? It's overwhelmed. So the way that a lot of people have to actually try to get into rehab, especially when you don't have resources, right, to go to like a fancy by the beach, pay out the pocket situation, is that you have to just keep calling. Like you have to keep calling. And I mean like keep calling every 15 minutes. Keep calling and hope that when they answer the phone that one time, that they'll say they have an open bed and you can say you can take it. So like thinking about that and having the literally people would be on their phone, like their phone call that they have, their time that they have, their 15 minutes, calling different rehabs, trying to get into a rehab facility, right? And then like if they couldn't get into one, they would just be sitting in prison. So it's like people don't know that like these things that we're like, oh, this person just go to rehab. This person just go do this. And it's like they actually want to. Like they want to, but one is not available. It's really hard to get into. And then also, like if you read different, look at different like documentaries and read different things, some of these rehabs are actually like filled with drugs. So you gotta make sure that you're in the right rehab that is actually doing the right thing. And sometimes you don't know until you get there. So it's just so many layers. Like even when someone's trying to get help, they may not receive it.
Yeah, God, it's so sad. All right, so I want to talk a little bit about birthing liberation, because
Okay.
I loved it. I force, often under threat, everyone I know to read it. I have chased my oldest child around the house quoting from it, and I think it's such a wonderful book. So I would love it if you would tell listeners a little bit about the book, the themes you touch on, how you came to write it, and what this book is about.
Yes. So I came to write it. I feel like I've labeled myself recently, maybe like, I don't know if it's a chaos writer or a crisis writer or something around that because I wrote that book like peak, like I started writing it anyway, like peak COVID, like peak, like don't go outside. We still don't know what's going on. And now I'm in the process of like starting to write my second book. And I'm like, maybe because the world is burning again. I feel the need to write. But when I wrote that book, we were definitely peak COVID. It was a lot of, Black Lives Matter, a lot of racial things going on. And one of the things that really came to mind for me was like, okay, when we're thinking about racism and everything about the medical industrial complex, like I didn't want to write for just the moment, even though I was inspired by the moment, because that moment in 2020, 2021 was also like a symbol of what we have been dealing with for years, right? Generations. So I wanted to write a book that could be timeless, if that makes sense. And so I wrote about the book starts off with a story about a person moving through the birth experience, a Black person moving through the birth experience. And it's a very common story. That story was like a reiteration of stories I've heard time and time again. But the thing that I thought was really important was that when we're talking about the story, naming about the different perspectives that are happening, right? Of course, it's the person who's giving birth. It's the father of the baby. It's the grandmother who that's there. It's the nurse and her experience. It's the doctor and their experience. And everyone is moving through something. Everyone has layers. And so what I really wanted to pull out was, yes, this conversation about racism, trauma-informed care. I have somatic practices in there, and also a vision of what collective liberation can do, how it can be modeled, and the care that we receive. But I also just wanted to bring like humanity to all of the people who are navigating this process. And I think when we talk about racism, especially, right, it's like hot topic. People are getting their feelings. I'm like, everyone is impacted by racism. Everyone. Yes, Black and Brown, Indigenous, people of color are impacted by racism, but also so are white people, right? And that was a point that I wanted to get across that right now we live in a time and still do live in a time where people are like, oh, we have to help the people of color with racism. And I'm like, no, you are just a part of the mission because you are impacted as well, right? And when I say that white people are impacted, what I mean by that is there is white supremacy, right? And white supremacy is not just supremacy over black and brown people, it's also supremacy over other white people and how we think we have to show up, or how you think you have to show up, because I am not white. But how you show up and like having to be the most powerful, having to be the smartest, having to be this, having to show your worth and your value and what you have versus who you are, right? And so for me, it was like, how can we start breaking that down? And also talking about the fact that doctors and nurses are also navigating difficulties no matter what color you are. So my whole piece is always to bring humanity, to bring accountability as well, right? Because we all have done something that impacts or harms somebody else. And also to bring the opportunity to grow. And I don't think we always get the opportunity to grow. I think even when we talk about racism or any type of thing like homophobia, transphobia, we're just in this space where you have to know all the facts. You have to get it right. You have to say the right things. You have to, if you don't say it exactly right, everyone's going to call you out. You're going to be, embarrassed that everyone hates you. And I'm like, what if that person is in a process of learning? How will they learn? Right? If learning and making mistakes is all about shame, then how will they actually be able to practice? Right? And I think, like, for me, it's important to give people space to practice, to learn, to be in community, right? That's to me is what being in community is about. So I just try to foster that space in the book, and I also try to foster that space just in life.
Yeah, I love that you're talking about fostering space to learn because this is something I have been writing about and thinking about and struggling with a lot for a long time. How we bring more people into the fold, how we avoid shaming people who are have good intentions and are trying, but how we also hold people accountable. And it's such like a challenging balancing act, and I can feel in myself getting activated and constantly going too far in one direction or the other. I think that's something pretty much all activists struggle with. So I wonder if you could speak a little more about how we bring people in, how we invite people to participate, how we allow people to experiment and get things wrong while also protecting people from harm.
Yes. So the first thing that comes to mind is that I don't think that we can protect people from harm. I think that we can do some harm reduction. I think that we can try to facilitate maybe some agreements, like group agreements and things like that, that can be helpful to creating the least amount of harm that we can. But I think to like not create harm is something that's unrealistic. And I think that's also what holds us up. Now, I think there's a difference between harm and someone calling me a racial slur, right? That's different, right? That's a okay. But I think it's different. It's a different type of harm that can happen if, let's say, someone has a belief around me as a black woman that they bring to the space. Like they may say something like, "Oh, I didn't know that your hair could do this," right? Like they might have really genuinely not have known, right? They may not have known how that was maybe stereotypical or harmful or whatever, but that is the difference. So I think there's a we have to one differentiate that. Like what is like really explicit and like no, aiming to be harmful. What is maybe implicit? Yes, hurtful, harmful, but not meaning to be. And where's a learning opportunity? And so, in that though, I think one of the things that we need to do communally, and what I think we do well in BADT, is creating a space for that. So when we have group conversations and we're in space together, we name, hey, here's our group agreements. And I also know that some of you are at different levels of learning, right? And so, because you're at different levels of learning, maybe when it comes to pronouns, you may not get it right, right? But if you say someone's pronouns and it's incorrect, I need you to follow up with an apology and correct it and move it along, right? So, we set up those kind of like systems. And you can't set up a system for everything. And then we also have spaces where we say, hey, if something happens, some level of harm happens, then let us know so that we can talk about it as a community. I don't think that we live in a world currently that allows for that. One, we don't have intentional spaces. We just put each other all in a room and just hope for the best. Two, we don't want to name that harm is unavoidable. Now the levels and the amounts and the types of harm can be different, but it's just unavoidable. No one's going to be perfect. Even me, right? Me, I'm a teacher. I talk about all types of things. There has definitely been times where I have said something just not thinking, just using a terminology. So I remember one time I was actually teaching my racism and privilege course, okay? I'm teaching it, I'm in person, I'm doing the thing. And I said powwow as just hearing it as a phrase of me talking to someone, right? Like you have to think about, and I was like, because it's language, right? Language is so nuanced, right? So me hearing that term, I said it just not even thinking, right? And someone was like, hey, that's offensive to me because as an Indigenous person, right? A powwow is a celebration. It's just, and I was like, you're absolutely right. And I apologize. Right? I apologize. My brain went to it. I'm hearing it as a phrase, and I know better, but even still, I still put that out there. Right? I apologize. And I thank them for calling me out in that time and for us being able to hold that complexity and to move forward. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's also such good modeling of how to respond to someone giving you feedback about their experience with you and how you've affected them.
So I think we have to do more of that. One intention, naming what can be awkward, naming where the lack of education may be, and then also naming how we want to recover. And also too, the other thing that I think is, I don't say it's controversial, but I have tried to do the work within myself to say, if someone harms me, what is the work that I have to do for myself? Right now, someone may apologize to me and they may do that work, but I'm a Black woman in America. There's a whole bunch of people who don't apologize to me. You understand? So since they don't apologize, where is my work to take care of myself? Right? Because even if someone gives me apologies sometimes, it's still not good enough, to be honest. So sometimes there's work that I have to do. There's a responsibility within myself to say, it is not my fault, right, that this thing happened. I cannot control this other person, but I gotta live with me. So how do I take care of me? Because at the end of the day, that's who I gotta sit with. So I think also there is a piece, right, around how do I recover? What do I navigate? How do I navigate? Where are my boundaries? And also naming when I don't want to be in a space where people are learning. Right. Some days people want to be in BADC spaces where people are learning. And sometimes they're like, I'm too active and I have too much going on. This is not a space for me today. It's not a safe space for me today based on my capacity. And that's okay.
So what you're saying is that if you're having a bad day, you shouldn't just start yelling at people online. That would be a bad choice.
I think we're so especially because of the internet and all that, we're so we put ourselves in spaces sometimes, not, it's like, you have a bad day. I know there's some days I have a bad day. There's days where I'm looking at the news and it is just chaotic. Everyone is like in my head, right? Everyone hates Black people. I'm activated, right? And I'm activated for the right reasons. I'm seeing a lot of BS happen. And when I'm activated on those days, I'm not going to be on the internet in certain spaces. I'm not going to read more about that and look at the comments. I'm not going to spaces that are learning spaces with people I know that have a deep curve in their learning. I'm not going to do that because I know that it's not going to be good for me. And I know that I don't have to be the superhero Black woman to come in. And I also don't have to be the person who who's arguing and prove, I just don't have to do that. So I think there's and that's what I mean about the self-responsibility. I'm not in a good place today. I'm not going to put that type of information in my face today because it's going to make it even worse for me. And then I may be reactive. And now I'm finding myself have to apologize for something, right? So it's also like that self-monitoring and knowing yourself, that's also really important.
Yeah, it's well, and it's hard because I think that getting angry and consuming things that make you angry and fighting with people who make you angry can often feel like activism because we get really impulsive and it's like someone's wrong on the internet and I have to go correct them and I have to, performatively do this. And you get that little like dopamine hit and you think you've done something of value, but you've just made yourself and probably other people too feel like garbage.
And the other thing too that I like try to say try to say to people who are well-meaning, right? Just across the board, the internet in some ways is just not real.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Like, I have seen so many people who are just they're building these followings off of being on the internet, saying a thing, saying, posting stories about whatever. But when you ask them, what are you doing off the internet? Right? Where's your impact? Where are you holding space in your community? Where are you creating resources? Where are you distributing resources? Where are you in relationship with people in your community? Don't nobody know them,
Yeah.
right? Like there
Yeah.
is no actual like outside of the internet stuff, and the internet can be used to educate and to spread, information and things like that. But also, like people need to step outside their door and know who their community is. They need to check in with their friends. They need to check in with their family. They need to. Like those are the things that matter. And I think the internet can really pull us into if I perform on the internet, then I'm doing my work.
Yeah.
But you
Yeah.
have to ask, what is this, all this posting or commenting, what is my actual impact and what is my intended impact? And usually they don't match up.
That's such a simple and helpful question. I love that and I hope people will take note of that. So I want to talk a little bit about birth because that's one of your many areas of expertise. I want to give people some statistics because I know not everyone is aware of kind of the way things are. So giving birth today is more dangerous than it was a generation ago. Things are getting worse, and Black women are hit especially hard. Black women have at least four times the maternal mortality rate of white women, and it's actually probably worse than that. The research shows us that no amount of money, class privilege, advocacy, education, nothing protects Black women from the risks of our maternity care system. I live in Georgia, where the maternal mortality rate is even worse than the average in the US. Our maternal mortality rate here is higher than that of 100 other countries, including impoverished and war-ravaged regions. It's difficult to overstate how bad things are. But it's not just maternal mortality. And if we only look at death, we kind of miss the bigger picture. It's also near misses. I think the latest statistic is what? It's like 50,000 women almost die giving birth because of delayed and denied care. And then it's the mundane, it's traumatizing births that leave families and sometimes entire communities injured and suffering. It's really scary and it's really sad. And I think a lot of people hear about the horrors unfolding in the birth system and they think that this is a new problem, that the system has somehow fallen apart, that it's like Donald Trump's fault or capitalism's fault or whatever. And it's true that a profit motive continues to erode our healthcare system, but a lot of it is the system working as intended, and especially the racism has been baked in for kind of the history of obstetrics. And you give a great overview of that. So I'm wondering if you can give a bit of an education about that.
Yeah, for sure. I think, yeah, there's so much. Let me get my thoughts together. Yeah, so what you're saying is true, and that this is not new. When we talk about the history of the work that we do, especially birth work. And I mean that from like doctors, midwives, everyone has some lineage. I think the first thing we have to talk about is midwifery. Yes, I'm a doula, right? So I'm the emotional support, educational support. I'm that person. And then we have a step up, a very huge step up too, is a midwife. So midwives are probably known at this point, I think, depending on what state you're in, for being in a hospital system, but also being like at home, so doing at home births, water births, birth center births. But the thing about them that people don't realize is that the history of grand midwives, what we call them, is actually one, it goes back to Africa, right? For Black people specifically. And then when enslaved people were brought over here, they brought over their midwifery practices. Those midwifery practices advanced into taking care of their enslavers' kids, birthing their enslavers' children, right? And also taking care of the people, right? So if you were a slave at the time and you had to wet nurse a family, right? Like someone else's children, there were midwives and also other women in your, in your on your plantation who tried to feed your child while you couldn't feed them. So we get from that to like the 1950s or so, where hospitals started to say, oh, well, let's bring birth really into the hospital system. In that process, that meant that they made grand midwives who were traditionally trained. They made them start, working within the hospital system. They also started to like demonize them by saying that their outcomes were bad, which weren't true. And then they also provided a lot of things such as like testing, right? So like the kind of testing we see now, standardized testing. The thing about that was a lot of the grand midwives did not have, they weren't, sometimes they could be illiterate, and sometimes they could just not have the comprehension level to take tests. So then that, and also they made grand midwifery or midwifery at home illegal pretty much across the board. And so what we have now in our current world is midwives, and probably I think 3 or 3 or so% or less are Black. We talk about indigenous. I think that's 1% of the midwives in the U.S. And so I'm just kind of make that connection between like history, right, and where we are now, right. And then when we talk about physicians specifically, we have to really talk about Dr. Sims, right, J. Marion Sims, the father of gynecology, who tested, not tested, well, yeah, tested. Surgeries such as C-sections and so on enslaved women such as Antarctica, with no medication, no pain relief, no nothing, right? And even at that time, there were people who were against that. Even if that was a time of slavery, some people were still like, hey, that's not right. And so now we have this education that we have and these, and literally these procedures that we have because they were practiced on enslaved people. And so when we look at that and we look at like gynecology as a practice and the medical system as a practice, how can a system that was born in that type of cruelty, really, like cruelty, unfairness, manipulation, so on and so forth, be a space that is safe for everybody? It's not. So we still see that as a reflection now when we're looking at our birth outcomes now. And when there's the research has showed that even when, people who are pregnant, Black people who are pregnant, receive earlier medical care when they're pregnant, when they receive, when they're at a different education level, when they have all these like positive things going, good health, whatever, they're still seeing the same outcome, right? That's why we see the Serena Williams having complications, why we see the Beyoncés and this and that and those, and everyone who's like, oh my gosh, you're so rich. Right? Like, how could they have a problem? How could they have these kind of outcomes? It is racism and discrimination that is really the underlying theme of our current medical system. And until we build something different, right? Like, we won't see anything different. And there are different people who are building different systems, but the problem with that is money and resources have to be given to those systems that are working, but they have to be scaled to actually be able to access everyone. But the last thing I'll say is when we're talking about scaling these efforts that are already happening in different communities by different midwives, doulas, even physicians, right, who are different, who are doing a different model of care, our medical system right now is also based in capitalism. So it's kind of like, well, if the money can't move or make 10 times what it can, what it's been given, if it can't grow as fast as we want it to grow, then it's not worth it. And one of the things that we have to like really, really advocate for as people is that care is more important than profit. And right now we're in a system that is profit over care.
Yes. So I know you know this, but listeners may not. So right now in Georgia, we're having a big fight over black midwifery. And what's going on is there's a group of black midwives who call themselves community midwives. So these are midwives who serve primarily in rural disenfranchised areas, and they do home births. Some of them also do hospital births, but it's mostly care at home. And what's happening is in the areas where they serve, there are no care providers. There's no hospital, there's no obstetrician. And these are the women who are saving lives. They have great outcomes. They have deep ties to their communities. Often their grandmothers, their great-grandmothers, and their great-great-grandmothers were midwives. So they have generations and generations of this history. And what's happening to them is they serve their clients and then they get prosecuted, because they are not licensed medical professionals. So they say, okay, well, license us, but there's no money in licensing them, so they don't get licensed. So these women are presented with the conundrum of continue to serve your clients and save lives and risk jail, or don't do that and watch them die. And this has been going on for years and years and years. And it's the solution is, to me, so obvious, but there's no money and there's no acclaim in it, and so it just doesn't happen.
Sure. And we also have where we do have spaces where, and I think another thing people kind of like get confused about is when we talk about a home birth midwife, they are doing one extensive care. They're talking to a client for like an hour, right? There's no, and that's, and I'm saying that as a minimum, right? I, as a person who's a doula who works with home birth midwives who I love, like there is no 15 minute appointment. It's going to be an hour plus, okay? They're also doing like check-ins. They're talking with them in between appointments. They're giving like full holistic care. Then when we're talking about actually being on call, being at births, like where we have other practitioners who are working on shift work, right? So every 12 hours they're usually changing their shift. If you're a doctor, 24 hours or so. Our home birth midwife is there the whole process. It could be 2 days. Right, it could be some time, right, as a doula and as a midwife, as well as giving that again once you have the baby, having a visit the day after, having a visit a couple times in that first week, having a visit a couple times in that second week, right? It is very extensive, holistic, integrated care. And so when you're doing that, you're also doing a bunch of blood work and this and that and tools and supplies, and you have a student midwife, hopefully, and hopefully you can pay them. But it's well worth thousands of dollars. And I think the thing that's also holding people up is that they're seeing now that Medicaid is covering doulas in some areas and also covering midwives in some areas. But what they don't know is that when you look at the rate, it ain't nothing. It's not nearly worth what that midwife is worth. So we have people serving their communities either for nothing at all, right? With legal threats, impending on top of it, but also being like, what is the other choice? For me, I live in a rural area. I live on the land of my great-great-grandparents who bought this land to get free from, enslavers. And so for me, I know about the community midwives here. Right. I know about the people who birthed my actual family, literally. And them women did not get, there wasn't a system of like getting pay. There was no, you could pay all your bills. It was community love and it was community resourcing that helped keep these women alive. But now in this world of capitalism, we don't have that. We don't have like the ability to resource midwives the way they need to by the community alone, because nearly everyone is struggling, right? Like we don't have the, even we're talking about doulas. Doulas were not as much of a thing years ago. Why? Because your mom and your aunts and everyone had the ability to come and be surrounding you during your birth. Now your grandmother, the grandma's still working.
Yeah.
Aunts are working. Right? Like, there's so many people who are working now because of capitalism, where like our grandfathers will come and their one income will hold the house down. We got everybody got working here. Right? Like, it costs to have a baby now. It
Yeah.
costs to go to the hospital and have a baby. Even if you have insurance, people are leaving with $10,000, $20,000, $30,000 plus bills to have a baby.
Yeah,
It is just a
it's
huge disconnect over, again, care and what we need as people, as communities, no matter what your color is, no matter what your sexual orientation is, so on and so forth, versus like everything being about how much profit can be made off of someone's body.
So bad. And so I'll tell you, I've got an international audience, and so some of them are just totally unfamiliar with this idea of paying for healthcare. So I'll it's so awful. With my first child, I had an unmedicated, natural, no epidural, not even an IV, not even an injection birth at a hospital. Nothing went wrong. I needed no medicine. All I needed was someone to sit with me and I guess make sure I didn't escape or throw the baby or something. And, we left after a day, and then we got our hospital bill. With insurance, it was $14,000. And, and we go through it, and there's like all kinds of charges for services we didn't get. But, there's no one to call. There's no way to fight this. We're just all completely dominated by this system that doesn't care.
Yes, and it's really important to say, like, I read a lot of books, like being in a rural South, like I'm around my elders who literally were born in the 1930s, 1930s, 1940s, and they were around when like they were like my aunts and uncles are like, go to the hospital. No, like we weren't even allowed to go in the hospital. Like, that wasn't a thing. It only became a thing when black bodies could be commodified. How much can we make? Right? What bill can we send after the fact? Right? That's when Black people started to be allowed into the system. But one of the things I think is important to name is that for generations, Black, Indigenous, Brown folks who live in the US, we took care of ourselves through community, through midwifery, through medicine people, through plants, through all those practices. And we kept ourselves, I would say, pretty well, right?
Yeah.
And one of these books that I read, it was really significant and important to name that they said, one of the medicine people said, if we become like addicted or dependent, I should say, on Western medicine, we will continue to lose our freedom and we'll never have it again. Right? And when I think about that, I'm like, oh, right. I could look at this space now we're in and say, like, oh, because we have one, legal issues around such things as midwifery, two, because it's inaccessibility, even if people do have the legal right to be a home birth midwife or whatever, it's expensive. Even to have a doula could be expensive, right? If you don't have it supported by Medicaid or like a work benefit. And I think about like how our dependence on this current system is also what keeps it going, right? Because most people are going to have their baby in a hospital. Most people are going to, if they have something wrong, go get a pill, right? Like, and there's nothing wrong with that. I take pills, I go to the hospital. Like, I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that, but I'm saying like how we have moved away from more holistic approaches. Well, like, for example, medications are, I'm also a herbalist. So a lot of medications are derivatives of a plant that probably grows in your backyard sometimes. So it's like we also have to like recognize how like our dependence on this system and it being the only system is also what keeps it going, right? Because it shouldn't cost you $14,000, but also in 10 years, it's going to cost $44,000. And it won't be much that we can say about it until we cre can create or support these other avenues of care.
Right. Well, and it is not a coincidence that these other avenues of care that BIPOC people have used for generations to keep themselves alive are now being criminalized. Like, that's not an accident.
I mean, I think, with the whole like, what is it that happened recently with Trump and whoever, but they like said that nurses are not professional
Yeah.
degrees anymore. professional practices anymore. And it's like, that's interesting, right? Because one, nurses run the world. Love physicians. I know some really dope physicians. And we also know that nurses keep it going, right? But I think looking at the world, we have to ask that question around like who has grown in the nursing space? And it's people of color. Right? People of color have really grown into that space and are really like taking up space there. And now it's like, oh, it's not a professional degree. Right? It's not a professional like workspace. And it's like, what does that even mean? Like, and it's so offensive, especially after like in the last, 5, 6 years, like just talking about COVID in itself. What? These nurses and physicians were saving lives or dealing with so much death because of their commitment to this work. And so it's just really wild to me. And I will also say that for Black and Brown people, Indigenous folks, like I'm seeing this buildup of people getting back to learning how to farm the land, learning how to work with plants, learning home birth midwifery, learning how to be a doula, learning to like do these things that are in our tradition that has moved away or escaped or been less accessible. But I see us doing that work and really starting to build more autonomy. It's going to take time, right? Like all things, but I see it. I'm doing that work. I see other people doing that work. And I think that's going to be essential to how we move forward.
All right. So you mentioned doctors. So I want to talk about doctors a little bit. One of the things that struck me about your birth or about your book, your
Was
book
like your
on birth,
Canadian,
there we
I'm telling
go,
you. Yeah.
is the theme of trauma integrated like throughout the birthing system. Every time I do an episode about anything birth related, I get hate mail from obstetricians who feel targeted. And I tend to dismiss these messages as powerful people lashing out against marginalized groups who are demanding better. But I also know that everyone in a broken system suffers moral injury and that it's often not easy to be a doctor in the system. I hear constantly from doctor friends about how a broken system inhibits their ability to provide truly comprehensive quality care. It's literally not possible and it's not their fault. I'm wondering if you have some thoughts on the defensiveness doctors sometimes feel, and how that relates to the overall trauma of the system.
Yeah, I'm gonna start with what I say to people all the time, which is like, baby, we gotta do our own work. We gotta do our own work. We gotta do our own work. And why I say that is we live in a divisive time. Everyone's wrong. Everyone has an opinion. Everything's black and white. There's no nuance. And sometimes what happens, right, when we're in that type of space is that we literally build a defensive nervous system, right? Meaning that everything is a threat. Anything that someone says to me is a threat. You look at me away, it's a threat. And so I think that one, when I said we have to do our own work, I mean nervous system regulation work, right? I need to sit down, I need to meditate, I need to whatever that looks like. So that's number one. Number two is that as professionals, physicians especially, obstetricians even more so, we have to be able to hold, you have to be able to hold nuance, right? And you also have to be able to hold that someone's experience isn't always a reflection of you personally, if that makes sense. One of the things that is really interesting to me is that, like, for example, me being a Black person, if someone has a black bad experience with a Black person, sometimes they put all of us in one group and we just all become bad. I'm like, what? That didn't have anything to do with me. Why am I now like a harmful person? What? However, it's so funny though when it gets flipped over to a more privileged identity and how like reactive they are, right? And I'm just like, this person, if someone is expressing I had a bad experience with my OBGYN, where can you open up to one, take out your feelings and think about this person's lived experience as a patient, right? And also, what can you learn from that experience? That doesn't mean that you yourself are racist or harmful or anything, but you may hear in that story something that you do that is harmful and you didn't know it, right? Like maybe they say, oh, the doctor asked me if I wanted, if I, the doctor didn't even ask me if I wanted to breastfeed. They assumed I was on formula feed and I think that's terrible. Okay, is that a habit that you have? Is it a, if it is, maybe you need to listen to why that hurt that person and think about how you can shift and learn in your practice. I think people take things personally sometimes because maybe it's something that they do, but maybe their intention is not to be harmful. Does that make sense? And I
Yeah.
think that when people hear something that sounds connected to them, they're like, well, I do that and I'm not a bad doctor, or I do this and I'm not. And I'm like, yes, because your intention, right, is not to be harmful, but your impact was harmful. And sometimes our intention does not match our impact. And guess what? When that happens, we have to now do some work. Right? We have to now do some work. And that's okay. Right? I think that, like, one thing we have to not be disillusioned by is power and privilege. Because when we get become disillusioned by it, then we become harmful. Nothing I do can be wrong. Anyone that has a, some feedback or commentary for me is being hurtful. And it's not that. And when I work with doctors, I can recognize that doctors are not having a good time in this world either. Like, I even talk about that in my book, right? I talk about the doctor who really, like, in the birth space seemed to be direct, detached, wanted to, you know, get right to whatever the procedure was. But really, that was because he had some trauma in the process of becoming a doctor, right? And so I want to name that, like, I can look at a doctor and see that there's humanity there. And in your role as a doctor, patients, clients, that's not their responsibility. It's just not. Right, their responsibility is to be treated by you, cared by you, and they may have some feedback. I may have some feedback, but you have to be able to do your own work of separating where is the lesson, where is what doesn't apply to me, what does apply to me. And also, every obstetrician is not the evil obstetrician that did this over here, right? It's just it's personal work that has to be done. And I think that people get disillusioned by power and privilege in those positions to think that no one should have feedback because I'm saving lives. And I'm so happy that you are saving lives. Thank you. And you're not obsolete from learning and being better in your practice. No one is.
I love that. I think that's such great advice. We just have to allow more space for complexity. And I think one of the really hard things about being a human is that one of the only ways to become a better human is to listen to the bad and unpleasant things people have to say about us.
Yes, and also just realize that, like, in no position, like, I don't care if you're a doctor, if you're the Pope, if you're a doula, if whatever, we as humans are inherently going to harm somebody. That is just it. Like, if we, I think even when we're talking about relationships, whether like really deep relationships or just like, you know, maybe more detached relationships. And because we are interpersonal beings, that means that we will harm somebody. And sometimes it will be that someone interpreted, for me, I'm a very like flat-faced, monotone person. So sometimes people can interpret my tone or my lack of affect as I have a bad attitude or I'm not interested. And really, it's not that. I'm just like that. Actually, the more monotone I am around you, the more comfortable I am. So but we all have our interpretations, right? Like we all have built up in our systems interpretations. We all have built up in our system lived experiences, trauma, things like that. And if we just have that ability to, like, for a second step back and say, I wonder what that person might be experiencing, right? Like when we talk about the trauma iceberg, I don't know if have you ever seen that image, the trauma iceberg?
Yes.
Right. So the trauma iceberg on the top is like this person is coming off like bad attitude or angry or detached or all these negative things. But in the bottom is like abuse and violence and they've experienced this and they've experienced that. And it's like we generally have the ability to do that for ourselves, right? Look at our own trauma iceberg, but we don't have the ability to do that for other people. And that's where the problem is. Like And I'm like, that doesn't mean that you have to go and get repeatedly harmed by someone. Push your boundaries up. Let people know that's enough, right? But also, like, we have to look at each other's layers and the ones that we don't see. I understand that most stuff is not personal. And if it is personal, some people are intentionally mean, evil, all those things, then you remove yourself out of harm's way. But I don't know. In my life, I feel like most people are not. People are really doing the best that they can, and I'm trying to do the best that I can.
I think that's wonderful. And I think that's a great place to wrap this up. Sabia, thank you so much for your time and for the wide scope of work you're doing to drive out injustice and build a better tomorrow. We are really lucky to have you in the world. And I really seriously mean that. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me. Thank you for such an open dialogue and yeah, just giving space for nuance. Not a lot of people want to hold nuance. People want things to be black or white, red, you know, right or wrong, good or bad. And I
It's
think there's a
easier
lot of
that
yeah, exactly, right? And we can all do like our moral high standpoint to like, oh, if I do this and you do this, I'm better. But I think like having these conversations and making space for these conversations creates space for the gray areas and the nuance and the self-discovery and the observation of other people and also kindness for ourselves and kindness for others and just realizing that we're all, whether we're white, black, or in between, we're all being impacted by all these systems in one way or another and a harmful way. Now, if we're gonna name harm, that's what we can name. Systems are intentionally being harmful, intentionally making us divisive. But we as humans have to find some kindness and love and hope and connection with each other.
Yes, absolutely. Well, thank you again, listeners. I'll put all of Sabia's information in the show notes. I will also put the trauma iceberg there. And thanks so much for listening.